Hello everybody, and it's a great privilege to be talking in the Linnaean Society surrounded by all of these eminent people, both real and painted. So my name's Max Barclay, and I'm the curator in charge of beetles at the Natural History Museum in London, just down the road. And my talk, Joe has said, has a title which is rather similar to the title of the talk that you've just heard from Darren Mann. He had entomological necromancy, and mine is called Conversations with the Dead. We're basically talking about the same theme, but we're approaching it in quite a different way. And I think that my approach is probably rather philosophical. And I'm really one of the boys in the back room. My job is sitting behind the scenes with the collections, maintaining the collections, working on the collections, developing the collections with a team of expert coleopterists. And public facing, if I do it, is a matter of personal choice. So I try to do as much as possible because I recognize that in today's world, taxonomy has been for more than half a century falling off the map. And it is even more important all the time to stress the importance of collections as natural habitats all over the world are disappearing. So the reason I've called it Conversations with the Dead is because of the labels on the specimens being written by people who are no longer alive today, that by reading the labels on the specimens, we can communicate with a past generation of entomologists and find their observations. So I study collections as well as beetles. Really, I study collections. Beetles are a secondary interest. And collections are more than just the sum of the specimens that are in them. Collections are a field of study in their own right. And I've said that the data labels provide a link between taxonomy and specimens and biogeography, ecology, history, and all of the important subjects that we can learn about from looking at the specimens in natural history collections. And finally, taxonomy is, of course, a hypothesis. If you name a new species, you are making the hypothesis that that type specimen is a distinct species from all of the other members of the genus. If you have paratypes, you're making a hypothesis that those are the same as the holotype. And in order for a hypothesis to be verifiable, it has to be backed up in a way that subsequent generations of scientists can confirm what you have discovered. And that's what we're doing in collections. We are making taxonomy scientific by providing the evidence that allows people to confirm or refute our hypotheses in taxonomy. So it's a slightly morose title, Conversations with the Dead. Now, I thought of this during a restructuring that we were having at work. And at that time, I used to spend rather a lot of time in Brompton Cemetery, where I used to go to cheer myself up. And Brompton Cemetery is a rather lovely Victorian cemetery just around the corner from the museum. It happens to lie in between my home and my workplace, so I can pop through the cemetery on the way into work and have a look at the graves and the very fine Victorian funereal architecture that's in there. And one of the things that I discovered was this, which is the grave of Sir Robert Fortune. And I don't know if Fortune is illustrated in this room. Probably not. Not in this room, but maybe somewhere in this building. But Fortune is renowned for, in 1848, bringing tea plants out of China and selling them to what was then the emerging British East India Company. So he effectively got the tea out of China and started off the Indian tea boom, which led to part of the growth. And I appreciate that there are people in the audience who know a great deal more about the British East India Company than I do, but this was leading to the tea boom in India, which led to, as Napoleon said, the British are a nation of shopkeepers, and the British Empire was very much founded on trade, and a fundamental keystone of that trade was the tea. So Fortune was a very important person in his day. He received a knighthood. He made a great personal fortune. He had children and grandchildren. He built a large stately pile to live in. And he had all of the trappings of success of the era. But all that's left of Fortune's achievements, the empire that he helped to build, the wealth that he put aside, the grandchildren, the house, nothing left. Out brief candle, everything is beneath that stone now, carved in a rock by the few people who remembered him at the time that he died. That would be all that was left of the achievements, the wealth and the worldly achievements of a leading Victorian, except for this. While he was out in China snaffling tea, he also picked up a few insect specimens. And those insect specimens are still in the Natural History Museum, and they are as good today as they were on the day that he collected them. The empire might be gone, the wealth and fortune might be gone, but the insect specimens are as good as they ever were. And in fact, they're better, because they were collected at the time when China had a population of 300 million people. That's less than the continental United States. Now, of course, it has nearly 1.4 billion. So these specimens allow us, or a contemporary Chinese scientist, to have a window into the past, into what the fauna of China was like at the time when it had a population just a tiny fraction of what it has today. You can actually look into the past habitats that no longer exist in a major country, a well-populated country. And every single one of these specimens, of course, has little labels saying where it was collected, what time of year it was collected. And you can compare this with modern data, and you'll find that some of these things have spread, some of these things have become extinct, some of them are still in the same status that they were at the time when Fortune collected them. So we have this amazing archive, this amazing window into the past of the fauna of North China. And that little story that I just told, that little vignette, it just focuses on seven specimens. So what is there waiting to be discovered on the labels of 10 million specimens of beetles that we have at the Natural History Museum? I'm going to start off with a quotation from George Bernard Shaw, that the true joy in life is being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, that being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I'm of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it's my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. Life is no brief candle for me. It's a splendid torch that I've got hold of for a moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to a future generation. To me, sure, he was a playwright, but to me, that's the mantra of a museum curator. We are laying down specimens for future generations, and we are attaching ourselves to something which is bigger and greater than a single human being, and making that thing better in the process. And I find that a very inspiring message. If somebody says, well, why do you have collections? Collections are the archive of the biodiversity of the world. And they always have been, but they're more important now because the biodiversity of the world is vanishing. And so as something is destroyed, the archives that remain of it become more important. The combined data labels of the world's natural history collections must be one of the largest unread scientific resources in the world. Every one of those 10 million specimens has two or three labels. Most of those labels have probably never been read by anybody who's alive today. We don't know what's written on those labels because we haven't read them. And increasingly, we're trying to digitize. This is a page of digitized specimens. Some of these Cato will recognize. And we're trying to digitize the whole collection. It's a very ambitious project. But make this available online so that a scientist in China who can't afford to come to London can look and see what was collected in China in 1848. Scientists in Venezuela can look at the jungles of Venezuela in 1880. That's an amazing thing to be able to make available to the world. Discovery and exploration of the natural world, say Ferrer and Flick, along with sports, music, and art, belongs to the class of human activities that are endeavors without end. These writers, writing in the Coleoptera's Bulletin, so they're also museum people, have said that, you know, the quantification of nature is something which is a fundamental human need. So, geographical explanation. If you're doing geographical explorations, you need to have detailed and accurate maps of everything that's already known. And in biodiversity exploration, these maps of what's already known are what are called natural history collections. And just as maps are an ordnance schematic key to the world to facilitate interpretation, so natural history collections and the taxonomic principles they enshrine are an ordered and schematic key trying to make the diversity of the world accessible as a tool and an engine for science, but particularly for taxonomy. We're trying to make the chaos and the variability and the endless diversity of the natural world into something that we can manage and quantify and understand. And millennia of human lifetimes have been spent building and maintaining the world's great natural history collections. If a collector, a private collector, was to work on their collection for just an hour every evening, that makes up 20,000 hours invested in that person's lifetime. That's even quite a modest private collection. It's a recently acquired collection by the Natural History Museum, the collection of this gentleman, Luigi Magnano. Luigi Magnano was an Italian tailor, but he was also one of the world's leading experts on the pest weevil genus Otiorhynchus. He was a borrower from the museum, and in 2014, we acquired 45,000 specimens, including more than 1,000 type specimens that Magnano had had in his basement for the 60 or 70 years of his active life. And when he died, they came to the museum, and suddenly they become available to the entire taxonomic community of the whole world forever. And this is this man's legacy. Private collections, you sometimes hear people complaining about private collections. Oh dear, that specimen shouldn't be in a private collection. Private collections are like the streams and tributaries that feed into the rivers of the big institutional collections, and those in turn feed into the sea of human knowledge. So the private collections are feeding into the museum collections. And this is because a museum specimen lasts for hundreds of years. And of course, a collector doesn't last for hundreds of years, much as we might like to. So the phase of being in a private collection is only a very short part of the life expectancy of an insect specimen. Collections are the conscience of the world, says Professor Richard Fortier at a talk that we did together at the Royal Geographical Society a couple of years ago. They show us not only what we have, but also what we have lost. And with the destruction of the natural world, the urgency to document and understand and quantify and collect and describe the biodiversity of the world is constantly growing, and therefore the importance of natural history collections can only increase. Why is taxonomy important today? Quentin Wheeler, former head of entomology in London, he's now working in a state museum in the United States. I think future generations will be appalled that when it was so easy to explore biodiversity, and we chose not to. There is an amazing indifference to the study of biodiversity in the world today. And it's very difficult to explain, it's very difficult to understand that we have this infinite diversity around us and we don't really care very much as a species. Reminds me of the legend of the Sibylline books, which many of you will know. The story is that the Sibyl, the prophetess, she offered to the king of Rome 9 books containing the sum of human knowledge for an exceedingly high price, and he refused to purchase them. And so she burnt 3 of them and offered him the remaining 6 for the same price that she'd offered the original 9. Again, he refused, whereupon she burns 3 more and offers him the last 3 books for the price which he could originally have obtained, the 9. And he is so shocked by the decay of knowledge that he's seen and witnessed and been partly responsible for that he purchases the last 3 books for the price that he could have got the whole lot if he'd acted quicker. And that is what we're doing with biodiversity today. So what we're doing in collections, what are we doing? We're building a new fossil record, an archive of the biodiversity of the planet for present or future study that is as comprehensive as we can make it. You look at this nice piece of jewelry here. This is an expression I borrowed from Darren at lunchtime. This insect specimen embedded in amber. That gives us a little snapshot of what was happening 100 million years ago or 50 million years ago, depending on the age of the amber at that time. But when we build an insect collection, we can consciously direct what we put into it. So we are actually steering the fossil record that future generations will be using instead of just having it as a result of random chance. We're doing a lot of research trying to quantify the collections that we have. The last column here, this is the work I've been doing with Vladimir Blagodirov, is working out what percentage of known species are described in the natural history collection across the different orders. It's an average of about 40% of described species are represented in this one collection. Coleoptera is quite favorable with 45%, and some groups even going over 50% of described species. But this is, of course, only described species. And when the percentage of described species is high, it might be because there's still a lot of undescribed species. And how do you harvest all the information locked up in millions and millions of specimen labels? Well, there's this scheme that they're testing out at the museum at the moment called the Angular Label Image Capture Equipment, which is one of those forced acronyms, also known as ALICE. The idea of ALICE is that it can photograph a label using labels from lasers from various different angles, and then it can patch together a lot of different photographs to make a reasonable reconstruction that is readable of the label without taking it off the pin. And this is a specimen from Borneo, from Sabah, from Kundansang Golf Course. So we're able to find this on the map in Google Earth, Kundansang Golf Course, and you can see that it's up close to Mount Kinabalu, but it's surrounded by area that is more or less degraded and managed and without very much tropical rainforest. And one wonders how much of that tropical rainforest has disappeared since 1989 when that specimen was collected. Then, thinking of Borneo, one is immediately reminded of Alfred Russel Wallace. He had his birthday recently. A picture of him just across the hall there. Another one in the main hall at the Natural History Museum. Wallace, of course, was in Borneo. He originally went to the Amazon with Henry Walter Bates. He lost almost all of his collection in a shipboard fire on the way back from Amazonia. Fortunately, he used the insurance money to fund his 8-year trip in the Malay Archipelago. He made huge collections. He collected 80,000 beetles. He conceived the Sarawak law and the mechanism of natural selection, as well as the Wallace lines of biogeography. And he published his travel book, The Malay Archipelago, which, of course, has never been out of print. And these are some of the 85,000 beetle specimens that he collected, which are at the Natural History Museum. I know there's awful lot in Oxford University Museum as well. And they're distributed throughout the world because he was bringing them back and he was selling them through an agent. And so various museums and private collectors were buying them. He's, of course, quite famous for this species, which is known often as Wallace's golden birdwing, Ornithoptera coryssus. This is what Wallace was doing when Darwin was publishing The Origin of Species. He was taking this out of his net and opening its glorious wings, and his heart began to beat violently. The blood rushed to his head, and he felt more like fainting than he has done in the apprehension of immediate death, and had a headache for the rest of the day. So great was the excitement. We can probably all identify with that. Maybe not. But that was the discovery of Wallace's golden birdwing. He also discovered a load of these Cetonian beetles. He described 72 species of flower chafer, and the types of those are distributed through several museums, but a reasonable percentage, including all of the ones in this picture, are in London. And what's interesting is if we compare the types of Cetonian beetle collected in Borneo by Wallace with the types of the same group of beetle collected in Borneo by a recent Czech doctor called Milan Krajcik, we find a surprising lack of overlap between the species collected in the recent times and the species collected in Wallace's time. And that makes us ask, why is there a surprising lack of overlap between these two collections that were made more or less in the same place? Well, Wallace was collecting at a time, of course, when Singapore was a fishing village, when there were leopards, cloud leopards and things wandering about, and when oil palm was restricted to a few forests of West Africa. He was collecting in lowland forests that went right down to mangroves and joined the sea, rich alluvial soils. And Krajcik, in the 1980s and 1990s, was collecting on Kundansang Golf Course. So they are looking at a different version of Borneo. Borneo of 1860 is not Borneo of 1980. If we make the assumption that there is rainforest on Borneo, so the fauna of Borneo is still available to study in that rainforest, that assumption is flawed. There is not just one fauna of Borneo. The fauna available for study changes over time as well as over place. We're not dealing with a single robust continuous fauna or an ongoing opportunity. And we as a society invest so little time in sampling biodiversity that almost every expedition and every opportunity to record a data point is unique. Because ecologists have normal human lifespans of only 70 or 80 years, this concept is not properly understood or worked out. I like to call it the onion theory.
So you think of Borneo as being like an onion, and every generation takes one layer off the onion and throws it away. That's the rainforest of Borneo that in Wallace's time went right down to the sea, and now it's on a few mountains in the center that are inaccessible and difficult to plow up and convert into oil palm plantations. So every generation is taking a layer off and discarding it, and those layers come with their own faunas, which are not the same. There may be some broad overlap between them, but they are not the same. So we are losing biodiversity at a greater rate than we can even imagine, because biodiversity is not as homogenous or as uniform as we like to think it is. And all that we know about 1840s China is based on a few specimens collected by people like Fortune. And what we know about Borneo from the 1860s, or parts of Indonesia, what is now Indonesia from the 1860s, is just because one self-funded individual decided that that was what he wanted to do with 8 years of his life. And his labeled specimens ended up in museum collections. Natural history collections are distillations of the natural habitats of the world across time and space. When you distill a chemical in the lab, you break it down into its constituent parts so they can be separately examined. And that's what we're doing in natural history collections with biodiversity, breaking it down into its constituent parts so that we can study them. And collections are not dusty or neglected or forgotten in spite of what the media might tell you. This is the last scene from the Raiders of the Lost Ark. If you remember the film, he spends the whole of the film fighting Nazis and flying in aeroplanes and visiting pyramids and eventually secures this great treasure. And then you see it getting chucked into an archive at the end, and that's the end of the film. All the excitement is over. Now it's safe. But what I want to say is that the excitement actually begins when the object gets into the collection. That's not when the excitement ends. That's when the excitement starts. Going out into the field, into the rainforest, I'm happy for somebody else to do that. What I want to do is to see the material when it comes home. That's the interesting bit. Captain Cook and Joseph Banks, these are some of the oldest collections that we have. 200 years ago this year, this August, in fact, young Joseph Banks and less young Captain Cook set out on the first Endeavour voyage to observe the transit of Venus. That was ostensibly what they were doing it for. But Banks collected 20-odd drawers of specimens, and those still remain. And if you get into some of the collections that Banks left behind, you can see what was happening in Australia when no Europeans had had any impact on the continent at all. And that's a really interesting little window. And we may be able to get pollen off them and see what the fauna looked like, what the flora looked like. There's all kinds of studies that can be made with these 200-year-old Australian specimens. Those are not Australian, but there are several drawers that are. Some data labels speak for themselves. 7 of these scarabs were vomited up by a Somali woman in British Somaliland in 1913. We don't know why. Actually, this is a recently described species, funnily enough. I'd say that before Darren did. We recently discovered this collection made by David Livingston, small box. Came from a lawyer called E.Y. Weston, and it seems by looking at the auction catalogues of the Stevens auctions that he purchased them from Livingston's brother in the 1860s. And they've been sitting in the Natural History Museum, and because they're common specimens, common species, not in very good condition, nobody really bothered to look at them and see that the labels said collected by Dr. Livingston. This is an interesting thing. This is a group that I described recently. The whole genus, possibly a subfamily, is undescribed. And the interesting thing about these is that there is no specimen in any museum in the world pre-1950. And because we don't know about their biology, we don't know why the old people didn't collect them. They're only being collected these days. So they may be in some way associated with something. They might be parasitic in cockroach pests or something like that that are somehow associated with human modification of habitat. But until we work the biology out, we don't actually know what they've been doing. This is Oplistomus haroldi. This is a pest of beehives. Recently, it cropped up in Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula, attacking beehives. And by looking back through labels on specimens, we can see that there was plenty of information that it was associated with beehives and honeycombs way back in time before it emerged and became known to be a pest in that context. And another little story here is that this is Lourdes Chamorro from the Smithsonian. She and I have been working on an avocado pest that is a attacking avocados. Now, we all know from Twitter that millennials eat too many avocados. This is a famous expression. But in 2015, the Americans consumed more than 2.5 billion pounds weight of avocados, approximately 5 billion avocados. So it's a very big industry. It's worth more than biological science. So we've got a pest of avocado. We were able to identify it by going back to the Biologia Centrale Americana collections held at the Natural History Museum. And when I first announced this, some student put his hand up and said, does it really matter that it was described in 1870? Because you could have described it when it became a pest. It didn't have to be described in 1870 from some forest, because it wasn't a pest at that time, so it wasn't important. But what we were able to say is that if you know where it lives, you know where to look for its parasitoids and its natural enemies. And that is exceedingly important when you're trying to control a pest. Whereas if you don't describe it until it shows up in Florida and California raising havoc and you don't know where it came from, you can't fight it so well. So another little bit of research that we've been doing, this is a clarid, Necrobia violacea. It's found in this country. This specimen is from inside the skull of a 50,000-year-old camel that Robert Angus and this woman, Anna Holden, and I, Anna recovered it from the Rancho La Brea tar pit of California. And interestingly, this is a synanthropic pest species that has been supposedly spread around the world by human agency. So what is it doing 50,000 years ago in North America? That's a very interesting question because that's earlier than the earliest estimates for humans in North America. We're running slightly short of time. Mary Kingsley, explorer of the 19th century, she collected 7 beetles in Ghana. One of them is the only known representative of this species and genus that was named after her. So not a bad hit rate out of 7. And of course, Charles Darwin, we have a percentage of Charles Darwin's collections, as does Darren in Oxford. This is a recently described species, described in 2014 from a single specimen collected by Darwin. And Darwin observed in his notebooks that it reminded him of the devil's coach horse beetle that we get in this country. And this is what Darwin was doing as he was looking at South American insects, and he was remarking on their similarity to things that he knew from the UK, from his childhood collecting. And this is what set the ideas working in his head that species could be interrelated and could change. A relevant thing to this particular room, this is Lomaptera esmeralda, described by Alfred Russel Wallace in 1859. And he's reused a bit of paper. And the back of the paper, it says, meeting will be boardroom Burlington. And we think that this is Darwin's writing. There's an example of Darwin's writing. And it seems likely that this is a letter written by Darwin to Wallace saying that the meeting in July 1858, which is commemorated in that plaque, was going to take place in the boardroom at the Linnaean Society at Burlington House. And Wallace cut the label up and used it to label his specimen. Anti-intellectualism. I recently gave a talk in Minneapolis about utilitarianism and functionalism in collections. And this is something which I'm very concerned about and I want to finish with. I want to finish on. The talk I gave at the time, about 3 years ago, was that there was a functionalistic need to justify natural history collections. And why was it that art galleries and national parks and national monuments don't need to justify themselves in the same way that natural history collections? Well, we've got a collection of 10 million specimens with all of that information that I've just been talking about. We have to say, oh, well, we need it for food security. We need it to fight malaria. Whereas actually, an art gallery or a national park doesn't have to make such justifications. But what I've realized since then is that I was actually slightly wrong because I was ahead of the curve on the natural history collections. But increasingly in today's world, art galleries and national parks and everything else is also having to justify itself in very short-termist, functionalistic ways. And this is something which I think is what brings me out from my collection where I'd rather be into doing outreach, is to try to fight against this anti-intellectual functionalism which is creeping into society. There's a famous example that Margaret Thatcher visited the Natural History Collections. And she's supposed to have pointed to a fly and said, well, how much is that one worth? And it's the great unanswerable question, but these are the people who are holding the purse strings and who are making the decisions. And they still are. There's a recent law, of course, many of you will know about, the Nagoya Protocol, which is based on the Convention of Biological Diversity. And these two gentlemen, Dharma Rajan and Prathapan in India, have recently published a paper in Science, which I was an author on, suggesting that this legislation is misguided because it works on the fundamental assumption that collecting of natural history specimens is done for some kind of financial advantage. And the concern of the lawmakers is that these people are going out into habitats and collecting natural history specimens and not sharing the wealth that they're gaining from having collected those natural history specimens. And when you turn around and say, well, we're not doing it for money, we're just doing it for pure enhancing human knowledge and that the specimens we collect are to everybody's benefit, it sounds to somebody who is entirely tied up in politics and finances as being a story. And so frequently, legislation is based on assumptions that don't understand the iterative nature of the growth of human knowledge. And I think there's a big message there. And these poor guys, they've got students, they're entomologists working in India. They're not allowed to collect in their own country. Their students are not allowed to collect specimens. But the year that the Nagoya Protocol was ratified in most countries was also the year that saw the highest rate of destruction of tropical rainforest in the world's history. So this law is not doing anything to protect rainforest. All it's doing is protecting from knowledge of what's in the rainforest. And that is an exceedingly depressing fact. And these two gentlemen, they had this line in their paper, restricting scientific collecting to curtail biopiracy, i.e. trying to milk money out of biodiversity, is like demolishing your house to kill a rat. On the way into work, on the way into this talk today, I found this statue. And there's a quotation from John Ruskin, who I think was involved in building the Oxford University Museum. And it says, build as if you build forever. And I thought, that's the principle of it, laying down a natural history museum. You're doing it as if you're doing it forever. And this is what makes the tragedy that happened last week in Rio de Janeiro almost unbelievable, that the whole natural history museum, the whole museum of Rio de Janeiro has burnt to the ground. And to try to interpret this, the newspapers have completely missed the point. They've said, well, there are Egyptian mummies in there. Well, yeah, okay, there's Egyptian mummies in most of the museums of the world. They say, it's a great loss for Brazil. It's not a great loss for Brazil. It's a great loss for humanity. And that's the understanding that the press and the governments of the world haven't yet got, that this is to do with humanity. This has nothing to do with Brazil or one single country. So there are no private collections. All collections are part of the shared heritage of humanity. Anti-intellectualism in the short term is a threat in the long term. And utilitarianism and functionalism is a symptom of anti-intellectualism and short-termism. Impacts of natural history are iterative. They play out over generations. And just to finish, my last slide is our understanding of our place in nature and why we're here, why there are human beings, is because two young amateurs liked collecting beetles. This lecture is dedicated to everybody who's built collections and labeled collections and made sure that taxonomy and collections have got a future. Thank you very much.